Okay, so we have John Scheipel here today. Thank you for joining. Let's jump right into your career experiences, why don't we?
Thank you, Dave. I'm pleased to be here. So I grew up in the Midwest, Toledo, Ohio, not quite middle of nowhere, but we had forests all around us. And growing up, I was always good with computers, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And so I applied to MIT because I always thought that was a good school. And everyone said it was a great thing, and I got in. So I went to MIT. So I have an MIT computer science and computer engineering degree. Now, when I got there, a bit about my early career is like I didn't know what to do with myself or what I wanted to do. At MIT, you choose your major. You have to choose a major at the end of your sophomore year. And so basically, at the very last instant is when I choose my major of computer science. And in part, it was because I was good with computers. I didn't really want to do things like Mech E. Architecture, like kind of physical stuff. I just like the digital side of things. Now, also when I was in school, some kind of formative things happened where I've always had this kind of love-hate relationship with technology in that I never wanted to do ones and zeros. Like hardware for me, you know, if it's like, oh, electrical engineering versus computer science, it was computer science. I did not want to mess with chips and boards. I'm so excited. It's totally different now with the Internet of Things and these little Arduino boards and toolkits. That's not really electrical engineering. That's more like software. So I did software, but then at the same time, I didn't want to be, you know, let's work in the back end of a huge financial company or a very low level Microsoft assembly programmer or anything like that. Much less any of these weird ancient languages like COBOL. I didn't even want to touch that. And so when I was there, you know, there's the MIT Media Lab. So I made sure to get my advisor was at the MIT Media Lab. I was in the Interactive Cinema Group. I did what they had. MIT has a very good program. So look at your schools for it's called Undergraduate Research Opportunities Program, UROP. It's basically internships within the labs, whether it's the computer science lab, EE lab, architecture labs, you know, all that stuff. So I was at the MIT Media Lab, Interactive Cinema, and it was a fantastic experience. Not regret, but the only thing is the year after I graduated is when they actually formally created the Media Arts and Sciences degree. So, you know, I kind of took as much, you know, as much computer science as I didn't need to graduate, and anything I could take at the Media Lab that made sense, you know, from classes on like interactive exhibits. It was just an amazing experience. And back then, you know, words like visual computing, you know, that was like a color monitor that they came out when I was in school. That was a big deal. HyperCard, if anybody remembers that. But in 1992 or end of 92 or 93, Tim Berners-Lee came and spoke to my class. And everyone should know he invented the World Wide Web. And it immediately clicked for me, right? I was like, well, this isn't quite ones and zeros. Part of what I liked about, you know, one of my things I worked on at the Media Lab was this demo in HyperCard where you had a map of Boston. You'd kind of like draw out a box and pick like a style, and it would do a dynamic. It was all hacked back then. Demo or die was their motto. But this it would give you like a tour of Boston, like something you could definitely do pretty easily with today's technology. And so, but it wasn't ones and zeros, right? It was, oh my gosh, people are literally. I can see people using what I'm doing. So it was very exciting. I really, really like that. And so I did a lot of work at the MIT Media Lab. Now, I graduated in 93, and at the time, MIT was very intense. And I basically took a year off to kind of just enjoy the city. And at the same time, I like beer, and that was the Brewpub explosion. So that was a lot of fun. And I ended up, you know, we were living in Central Square. The Cambridge Brewing Company was a mile away, and I had a job across the street from the Cambridge Brewing Company at Mitsubishi Electric Research Labs, where it was the first year or two of their existence. They didn't even know what they're doing, so we're just proposing ideas for research, which is a freaking blast. So we were doing like learning environments for children, and what does it look like when a kid logs into a virtual environment and meets other kids, and you know, auto-translating kids' speech into other languages. I mean, all stuff that didn't exist at the time, and you could do some of it now. Lots of it now. Anyways, that was just a fun job. Now, again, early in my career, I don't really know what I want to do. But at the time, you know, there was like, I was into like electronica, techno music and stuff. And so I got into these music mailing lists and like chat sites and stuff. And I met this guy, Brian Bellendorf, who you can look him up, but he's pretty big, well known. He does a lot of cool stuff, especially in open source. ClabNet, if you guys know them. Anyways, he was my 19-year-old CTO boss when I was 22. To fast track that, but you know, we're hanging out in 90, you know, 94. So in 90, I stayed from 93 to 94 in Boston just to enjoy the city, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. Talking to just people, like, what should I do? Where should I go? Visual computing, what's interesting? CD-ROMs, right? Let's program CD-ROMs. Oh, okay, there'll be some graphics there. I'm using these like old ancient terms. It sounds not exciting, but those were the fancy terms back then. Gaming was big. I wasn't quite sure of gaming, even though I kind of did some work with Naughty Dog Software, you know, the summer of 93. I'm sure they don't remember me, but they're massive now, if you guys know them. But I heard of San Francisco, Multimedia Gulch. I also heard of like Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. So I was kind of considering, those were the two areas I was considering. Nowhere else really, I didn't hear anything good. I wasn't thinking of Redmond. I wasn't thinking of Silicon Valley. I'd heard of like SGI, the old hardware company. You know, they used to make pretty cool systems. They used to give them away for free, basically, to internet companies. That might have been, I heard that was a cool company. Sun, maybe I heard it was cool, but most of the part, I wasn't too into the Microsoft, what I heard about Microsoft, like, oh, they, you know, measuring you by who was in the parking lot first and who left last, like, I just want to have fun. Anyway, so I didn't know much, but I chose San Francisco. I had my friends from college from California were like, you would love California. So I'm like, okay. So I moved to San Francisco, and the summer of 94 before I moved, talking to this guy, Brian Bellendorf, on this V-Rave chat site that he ran. And he goes, oh, here, you moving to San Francisco? I'm like, sure. He goes, oh, you want a job? I go, sure. Where? He goes, Wired Magazine. I'm like, have you heard of it? I'm like, yeah, I've heard of Wired Magazine. I think one or two issues had come out at that point. It was very early for Wired. And so I got a job at Wired, but I was an intern. So this is kind of one of my first how did I build my career things. Well, I did internships in school, these year ops. Now, you got paid. It was better than minimum. You know, because I think a minimum back then might have been like $8. You're getting like $12 an hour, 15. I mean, because it is programming though, and they get MIT got a lot of money and funding and stuff like that. But at Wired, I was $100 a week intern for 3 months, and I had some friends. I had some friend, a buddy of mine went to Sapient, which was all MIT people. And that's a good, not great interview story, which I can come back to.
We're gonna get there.
Yeah, I have another one too. So Wired Magazine, I mean, it was amazing, like freaks, geeks. It was just like the coolest freaking place to be. And I'm not like a celebrity guy, but like, you know, like Bono would walk, not Bono, the Edge, the guitarist from U2, like walk through the office, like just famous people. The godfather of the virtual community, Howard Rheingold, worked in my office. You know, fun stuff like that. Internships are critical. So I did internships in school. I did an internship with Wired Magazine. And then, you know, my savings, just as they're about to hit zero, I got my first offer and it's like 16 or 18 K a year. My friends at Sapient were like, you could back then like 50 to 65 K might've been like a good salary for a good engineer coming out of school. They thought I was nuts, but like, you know, if I fast forward, I got invited to the Wired 20th, 25th anniversary parties. I get to go to those. They don't invite anybody after 10 years because there's just too many people that have worked there. It's just a fantastic network. I'm working again with this woman who, sometimes when I describe what I do, I say, I have more internet and company building experience than anybody I know. There's 11 or 12 people in the world I know that have this experience. And in part, this is Wired Magazine. So Wired Magazine, for anyone that doesn't know, I think it's the first commercial internet company. They invented the ad banner. So by day, as this intern for Wired, I needed to also make some money. I would go upstairs to Organic Online and I would build these websites. So Wired Magazine convinced Volvo, Sybase, I don't even know if they're still around, but a database company, Zima, if you guys remember Zima, the malt beverage. So they convinced these sites to build these little websites. Today they'd be these like static, ugly brochureware, but back then no one had done it before. Basically I joined Hotwired, it was called, the Wired Magazine's Wired Digital, their online efforts before it launched. And so they invented the ad banner, sold it to a bunch of people, and then basically invoked their hype machine and internet, and basically said the internet revolution is here kind of thing. Fantastic experience, amazing experience. Things I started learning though, very early, is a very young company. I don't think anyone was over 28 or 29. Like the CEO, the publisher, they were older, but no one was young. It was magazine editors managing coders kind of thing. It was the mess. But one thing, my first framework I learned, or I made up in my head. I didn't realize this at the time. Well, I realized it when I got the fourth letter, but I said, what am I looking for? Well, I want to be around good people. So Wired was fantastic with people, just amazing, amazing people. I need a good idea. Well, okay. So making sure you're getting a good idea, good concept, Wired definitely had that. Now, what Wired didn't have was management. Like, they didn't know how to manage anything, didn't know how to scale. Like, the CEO wouldn't buy pens. It's just weird little stuff like that. And then they also had a plan. So, like, over the years, as I was building my skills, which I'll kind of get to, my initial acronym was People, Idea, Management, Plan. Like, making sure whatever I was going into had that. And by the way, I didn't realize, but that's the acronym PIMP. So if you did that, you were PIMP. So that was kind of initially when I was feeling my way out. As long as it kind of satisfied those criteria, I tended to be happy. And as long as, like, got along with the people, those tended to be good opportunities for me. Let's see. It was also at Wired. So kind of 95 to 98 is when, the way I was raised, my dad's a doctor. There's a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which is really good. I recommend it, which is basically this guy had a dad. Yeah, his dad's an academic, basically, and was basically trained by, get a better job, buy a bigger house, get a better car. And you're basically just constantly upgrading your debt, bigger debt kind of thing. And that was his poor dad. And then there was his rich dad, was his friend's dad, who was rich and taught him all these different things, about passive income and like owning property. And, why, I started to buy a house, and kind of owning your destiny is one way I might say it. So my dad was never quite like businessman sophisticated in that context, but he did, he did promote this kind of own your destiny, right? Like, his partner owned the building they had their office in. When he was looking at the later stages of his career, do I retire and just do workers' comp for a day and a half a week? Or do I open continue my practice at 60 hours a week? Or do I open an outpatient clinic, right? He definitely thought pretty well about that. And he did, at MIT, I always thought, not MIT, but early on, like, I want to do big things. I want to do broad things. I'm not comfortable. Like, I don't know if I'd be a great CEO necessarily. I maybe now I could, but it just took me a long time to, be in front of people, lead, not quite take charge, but I did learn that, I want to do big things. I want to somehow own my own destiny. I wasn't really trained in business and acquisition. So for me, ultimately came about, what was this kind of training and cross-training. Oh, and another thing happened at the same time. In the 98, when I joined this company, Big Step, met this woman, Karen Jack, who really, now it's like 99, I met her, but she kind of rocked my world as far as like self-analysis. And one of the things there's all these self-help books and things like that, but there's a thing called the Enneagram. It looks a bit like astrology from the diagram, but it's not. You basically ask yourself kind of 100 questions. And then I found it really insightful in kind of figuring out who I am. And one of the things that helped me figure out, and so by the way, looking inward is very difficult. No one ever taught me that or trained me that until I met this woman. And I strongly recommend it. It's very difficult to do. And you share it with your loved ones and all that good stuff, your plans. And it's a really cool kind of process. So with the Enneagram, helped me. This was a tool to help me look inward. I forget exactly what I am, but I'm basically like 6 or 7 o'clock with like a left wing. Anyways, what I learned about myself was that I like to be the expert and I need to be the expert. And I always felt I'm a shy person. Any CTOs that meet me now, they're like, everybody. And it's so chatty. I'm like, I still feel shy, but it takes me a long time to warm up. Now in early or mid 20s, I learned about myself that in order to be the expert, I need to feel comfortable. So I like to learn. I always was learning and growing and doing is a big thing for me. And so if I'm not comfortable in something, I might give you an opinion, but I tend to be reserved. I'll be quiet, but then I want to learn. Once I learn enough, like, you almost can't shut me up about it kind of thing. And so starting at Wired, I started kind of the first 3 or 4 years of what I call training. Now, so let's say from like maybe 93, but 94 to like, 2000 for sure was kind of a hardcore training. Now, training, to me, this is related to your functional discipline. So I think this applies to any role, marketer, sales, whatever, QA. So it's what's core to your function, right? So for me as an engineer, right, you need to be able to, let's say, perhaps like write code, test code, things like that. As a DevOps guy, right? You have a different set of things. As the CTO, kind of the guy that runs the show, you need to know all of the things, right? So I actually went on a several year course of training, meaning learning all the skills I felt that I needed in order to be comfortable leading and doing big things. And not, I didn't think, oh, I got to be a manager. I got to own these things. I did think I need to own these things, but just managing wasn't the right way to say it or the path for me. And I had MIT computer science degree. That gets me a lot. That gets me very far. Programming, testing. Later, I'll come to this laboratory and software engineering class I took. Working in teams. Now, what it doesn't really teach you is things like maybe not, it, depending on programming and how you learn, like QA and testing. And we actually did a lot of that. We did a lot of specing. If you're in like a code school, you might not learn how to architect and spec if you're just writing code right away. That's a horrible idea.
I have a lot of opinions about that.
train, so QA. I previously, I might not have in the past said product management and project management were core training. I believe that firmly believe that is now. For example, if you're the tech lead at a company, that you're a project manager, right? Like you might even have a project manager, but you're project managing 3 to 5 or 8 other engineers pretty much, right? So you have to have project management skills. It might be easier because you're just talking to other tech people mostly. But if you're that interfacing with the rest of the company or with the product group, you're the project manager. So training, right, is learning all the things that go into it. You could get into, whether it's a database, relational, non-relational, distributed, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's all the things. You can thin slice this as much as you want, but it's basically how much of it you need to know to do the right things. I also include user experience in that, in core. Companies benefit greatly when I'm running product and owning product. It's kind of a separate thread in all this, but user experience is a big thing for me as well, and I do very well owning, running, controlling that. Controlling is not the right word, but I think you get what you mean. I don't want to be perceived as controlling it, but I need to control to do the right things. Mm-hmm. So training. So for example, on the user experience front, in 1997, I took a break and moved to LA. My brother lived here. I'm still building up. I'm still training, building up my skills. So as part, project management and user experience. It wasn't called user experience yet. So information architecture. I read probably, if you take textbooks, about 18 inches worth of textbooks, Designing the User Interface by Ben Schneiderman, Information Architecture by Lee Rosenfeld, stuff like that. And then I said, I'm an information architect, and I convinced GeoCities to hire me. It was only like a 4-month gig, but I'd lived in Venice, ride my bike 3 blocks to the beach, up a mile, ride my bike block in, and I was at work. It was great. It was fun. But at GeoCities, I redesigned their site from top to bottom. It was the fourth largest site on the internet at the time. And not quite the point of the story, but also at the time I invented pop-up ads for them. And so that was when I was also, that's when I kind of started to get into cross-training and understand things like, there's a business goal of either driving revenue or basically monetizing. Back then it was called eyeballs. There was no notion of click-through. There was no notion of, it was just CPM. That was it, period. And it was funny, at the time I was like, GeoCities, this is a goofball company. I was coming from the Bay Area, so there's a bit of this tech hubris. They're a $100 million company. Like, these guys are idiots. Like there's some smart people there, but one guy in particular running product, and he was running the front-end developers, was one of the biggest idiots I've seen in my life. And I've learned how to talk to those people now. Back then, it was hard to bite my tongue. But as part of that process, learning, they were trying to monetize their content on the site. Their idea in 1998 was to have a 10-second interstitial ad before showing all content. Now, in 98, nobody had Flash installed. The interstitials work on video. You would know that, Dave, right? They don't really work in most content sometimes, but like, I think a lot of like magazines, you can't really get away with a 10-second interstitial ad. Back in 98, so at noon they make the switch. Within a half hour, the traffic almost goes to zero. So they start freaking out on the plug. I'm like, I didn't know. I didn't have the language to talk about it back then, right? So I was starting to work on my cross training, which I'll explain in a moment. Basically, that afternoon, within a half hour, I said, by the way, there's a way to do this little new thing called pop-up, do a pop-up window. And basically, overnight, I increased their ad inventory 10,000%. They went from like one gold bar to 10,000 gold bars. You know, hey, one gold bar costs $10. Now we have 10,000 gold bars. And you're like, great, I would like a deal on gold bars. Like, nope, they still cost $10. That's when round trip revenue was still a thing, if you know that scam. I'm not saying GeoCities did it, but it was a thing. And a year later, GeoCities was bought by Yahoo for, I think, like $4 billion. So that's when I was like, wait a second. Maybe, you know, my business sense isn't the greatest. So in 98, I moved back to San Francisco. Well, I met this guy, Andrew Beebe, on the bluff in Santa Monica, just random chance. A lot of it's just, by the way, this thing I call serendipity or manufactured luck, in the sense that, like, if you do the right training and cross training, the right thing comes along, boom, it's just magic, right? So this is the guy I had met before. Just, oh my gosh, what are you doing here? I was like, actually, like, I went to this happy hour and there was nothing going on in LA. So I was like desperate to do something like that. I'll go to anything tech happy hour related. I was like, oh, I know this guy was like coming down with something. So I was like, I'm gonna leave early. And he told me his idea. And within a week later, I'd moved up to San Francisco to join his company. So this was bigstuff.com, a small business and tools and services. We ultimately helped, you know, hundreds of thousands of companies. This was a fantastic experience where we went to Sand Hill Road, got, you know, let's see, it's like, well, 250K from friends and families, then like a million or two from Sand Hill, then like 5 to 10 from Sand Hill. Then I wasn't really involved in round D at that point, because we did things like hire the woman that ran small business for Wells Fargo. And I was like, I do not feel qualified at all for a lot of this stuff. But a big part of that process was working with this guy who ran the business development, Bud Rosenthal. Now, sometimes, you know, I'll say things like, you know, you want people that work like you, that get things done. Now, I'm very detail-oriented and good with lists and this and that. And I'm not saying you have to work like that too, but you need to be able to get things done. You need to be able to explain things. Like, you need to be able to translate your stuff to mine or work with me on that, right? And so this company, before we launched, we launched July 4th, and the whole company was on board. So, you know, that was a fun experience, but I'm not going to recommend that in most situations. But anyway, so this guy, Bud. So one other thing, we were in a meeting, and I had to write down a quick example. Okay, so this guy, Bud Rosenthal, he was running business development. He was one of the co-founders of the company. We're about like 30 days from launching, and we're in a meeting, and one of the core strategies we have was co-branding. And ultimately, our company, we did deals with like Staples, Office Depot, Office Max, like this guy slam dunk. But it's the way he did it, right, that was just super enlightening. He basically, we were in the meeting, he's like, but we were asking about co-branding. And we were like, oh, crud, we didn't do that yet. And we knew it wasn't like the biggest of features, but we were a little bit like, you know, oh, shoot, we have to scramble to get this done. But before we got it done, Bud gave us a presentation. He goes, well, look, I want you guys to understand why we're doing this and kind of what my goals are. This may or may not help you. And what he did was he made like a 4x4 grid. Now, everyone in the company just understood our basic business and what we did. And so he was able to clearly describe the vertical and horizontal axes, right? So we're like, okay. And in it was all these little dots, and these dots represented companies. And some squares had a single dot and other squares had a lot of dots. And he said, here's my deal. If you guys build this for me, you enable me, my commitment to the company is to do 12, to take these 16 squares and lock up 12 of them. I'm gonna, whether it's the one deal with the one monopoly guy in that square or two or three deals to kind of get to the, you know, saturation of that space, that's what I need to do. And everything just click, 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 click. Everyone's like, oh, wow. Everyone gets super excited. So I want to say almost overnight, within 2 or 3 days, we got the co-branding stuff rolled out. Now we were so excited. We get the whole team together. We present it to Bud and his team. And then Bud's a bit of a jokester. He kind of goes, oh, he's like, you know, he goes, okay, well, I have a question. Ultimately, how long does it take you to do a co-brand? We go, oh, we didn't think of that. We chit chat real quick and go, 2 hours, right? You give us everything, we can launch it in 2 hours. And he goes, oh man, I wasn't thinking 2 hours. And we're like, what? Like, you gotta be kidding us. And then he goes, I was thinking 30 days. We're like, what? He's like, well, I gotta close the deal. From the time I close the deal, I gotta ask. It's going to take a week for them to send me this stuff. I'm going to give you guys a week. Now, keep in mind, if I'm closing multiple deals, right, you know, I got to make sure you guys can handle it. So we're like, oh, wow, he's already looking out for us. You know, and then they're going to review it, and then we might change it, and then we'll launch it, 30 days. And we're just like, it was just such this like big sigh of relief. And we're just like, oh, yeah. You know what I mean? And it was just that experience was so great, because he helped us learn, understand. And so that experience really cemented what I call cross-training. So cross-training is, roughly speaking, training in your cross-functional disciplines, your not core stuff that are still important, right? Like, I do not have an MBA. I kind of think I have an effective MBA. I don't want to be so arrogant as to say I have one, but I worked with some CEOs where I'm like, ooh, that have MBAs. I'm like, oh, goodness. You know, or if you ever worked with a marketer who's like, what's a funnel? You're like, you have to be kidding. Anyway, so cross-training, right? It's going out of your way to work with marketing, biz dev, sales, customer support, the CEO. And, you know, in the end, kind of one of your goals, I think, as CTO, you know, I like to use humor a lot, but like, you're a glorified translator, right? One of my superpowers or skills is I can translate business, creative, and tech, and back in roughly the three generic-y business languages. That experience starting in 98 was like a really big deal for me. Now, fast forward to like 2001-ish, I left that company and I took some time off just because I got really burned out and fried on LA. And then I moved, in San Francisco, and then I moved to LA, and I really like it here. Now in LA, part of it was LA is a very different environment. I was, especially back in 2003 or 4-ish, 2, 3, 4, there was no real good tech. Nothing was going on. Few and far between. So I took I worked at Hilton Hotels Corporation, Fortune 500 company. Damien Bean, if you know, he shows up at the CTO Farms. He was our VP. So like people you see show up 20 years later. And Hilton Hotels for me was large scale political project management. You know what I mean? Damien was the one kind of maverick Australian VP who was pitted against, Hilton had acquired this other company and they had like 50% market share or more. And the other company was the tech. And so Hilton was the brand. So the one VP in Beverly Hills who was Australian and like 10 or 11 VPs in the CTO from the other company that was acquired in Memphis. Damien's Microsoft. These guys are open source. On my first day of work.
Oh boy, I can see where this is going.
First day of work, boss says, there's two things you need to know. One is everyone's really nice. And I'm like, why is that? She's like, come on, it's the hospitality business. I'm like, oh, that's cool. It infects everything. And then I'm like, this doesn't sound good. What's it? And she looks at her right-hand man, Pete, and goes, Pete, what would you say? And he goes, basically, people come here to die. And I'm like, ouch. You know, I'm like, what, you know. But basically, that became an internal metaphor for our team because we had to meet with a lot of different groups. We basically like, hey, who's here to die, right? And we would either just know not to give them anything depending on their role or just give them something small enough. We knew they would fail and the failure would not. Hope they succeed, but know that probably assume they would fail and route around them then. So that was like cross-training, right? Large-scale, political, kind of project management. Now, part of this was that I was doing this on my own. Now, at the same time, around 2003 or 4 is when I stumbled up, the LA CTO Forum. And so that's when I started going to that. Okay, so after Hilton Hotels, and I want to say that was around 2004, so roughly 10 or 11 years into my career, is when I really was like, yeah, now I'll be a CTO. Other than founding companies, I don't know, founding company didn't quite feel the same. I don't know, it's just, I don't know, it's different. But that's when I really focused on, I'm like, yeah, I'm a CTO. And that was me having all that confidence, knowing enough on the functional, about data, about security, about front end, back end, middle tier, API, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then customer support, marketing, biz dev, sales. You know what I mean? Like I set up all their stuff now, you know, we set up all the biz dev systems, all the marketing stuff, all the customer support stuff. So of course, you know, you need to know that. So it's a huge deal. And so that was roughly kind of my individual contributor path. Now at the same time, knowing that I kind of came into the world in the era of shrink wrap software and, you know, especially 90s and 2000s, it was, waterfall, just kind of more monolithic type era, let's just call it, of computers. I felt very fortunate, to kind of have been kind of like born into my career when I did.
Back to the serendipity, right?
Yeah, back to the manufactured luck. Part of the luck I feel that I had, I was not misdirected, but I didn't have a singular goal or vision, you know, of like, I'm going to do X, Y, Z. But I knew just working with bright, smart people, I just found ways to grow, just keep pushing myself, keep challenging myself until I finally did, you know, okay. Yes, I am CTO. That is what I'm good at. That is what I want to do. That is what I'm happy doing. Doing the self, you know, kind of analysis, self-assessment, kind of figuring out training and cross-training. At the same time, in my readings, one of the models I liked was Sun Microsystems. And so this is kind of what originally inspired me as once I was getting, so this is kind of getting my own personal experience and then into becoming a CTO. What kind of CTO am I? Who do I want to be? One of the things, like in this shrink wrap waterfall software world, and this is kind of, I'm glad it's kind of more of a historic mindset, but it's this notion of, well, it's not, if you say like people rise to the level of their inability, that's universal and may never change. But this notion of, in order to get ahead in a tech company, you need to be promoted to management, right? That's definitely a shrink wrap CD, you know, worldview.
You mean dated?
Dated, yes, yes. But there were models at that time I did like. So Sun Microsystems, for example. I was at Wired, and the guys working on Java came in and were like, what should we do? And we're like, plugin, make it a plugin. I'm not saying we were the guys that told them to make a plugin, but like, hey. For a long time, Java worked in browsers.
So I was going to say, you should soft pedal the Java plugin and soft pedal the pop-up ads, I think.
I know. Oh, no.
You've already lost some listeners here.
Oh, I know. The other guy, there's another guy that claims to invent it. I'm not challenging that, though. I think I did it before. I know I did it before him. Okay, so Sun Microsystems. They had a good model where, you know, a lot of, like, I mean, I'm not saying it was Microsoft, but I think a lot of tech companies, it was just be, in order to get ahead, you got to go into management, and you're not trained for it. You don't know what's up, all these things. Sun Microsystems, my understanding, said a really good program for the individual contributor track as well. So they had a really good method and plan and system to like support a senior scientist, you know, a guy that could like conceivably, you know, stop the production line. Hey, there's a security issue. You can't release it. Like basically putting, you know, these guys on a par with management, right? That's when things get out of whack, when the management is like, I'm not saying they have the power and control, but they don't know what's going on, and they're just bad things are happening, right? If you've, you know, you do need these like individual contributor architects. You could argue a manager is an individual contributor manager, right? Now, if you're thinking of it that way, that they're just pure individual contributors, that's not healthy. Like we all know the kind of ivory tower computer scientist that's always right and doesn't want to listen to anybody. Well, that's not the healthiest thing in the world, you know. So as an individual contributor, right, that was very insightful. Now back then they didn't have things like EQ and IQ, which I think we might get into later, but that's I liked learning about Sun and how they were supporting kind of the tech people, and that seemed like a really good thing, and I kind of embodied that when I kind of switched over to CTO, like how do you support and keep your team going and all that.
Yeah. Along the way, through all these different, roles that you've been in and so forth, nothing, you know, happens in a vacuum. Clearly, the environment had a lot to do with it. I mean, you're at all these great companies early on and so forth, but there had to have also been people there that were encouraging your growth. So, I don't know, can you think of a few pivotal people along the way that helped you get to where you're at?
Yeah. So BigStep.com was a really amazing formative experience for me. So one of the reasons I think Big Step went so well was that early on as founders, the five of us spoke and said, if this ever gets out beyond us, we'll bring in the experts. I don't like to say we'll bring in the adults, but I think that was what was said at the time because we felt like kids. It's okay when the kids say it, but if I say that now, I'm like, I just sound like a jerk. And so, you know, I think for a third, we got up to like 10, 12 million in funding. We brought in Lucy Reed, who ran small business for Wells Fargo. I didn't work so much with her, but I worked with this guy, John Monson. John Monson was the general manager of Intuit when they basically kind of internet enabled the desktop app. Big deal. And I got to say, working with him, he was not a tech guy. He comes from the business side. He not even a COO, like GME, depending on how you find GM. And so you know, little things. Like, for example, at the time, I was burned out. After my first meeting with him, he would not let me work more than 30 hours for 3 months. That blew my mind, especially for a high growth company in San Francisco. Defies logic.
Is that 30 hours a week, 30 hours a day, or 30 hours a quarter?
Right, exactly. Exactly. No, yeah, 30 hours a week. I was like, oh my God. He did things like, you know, verbally, he had an assistant. I normally don't see them until companies get super big. So that was a little odd. But coming from where he came from, and it was awkward back then when they hiring, company growth was based on hiring, not revenue and things like that. But anyways, he was, he even used his assistant to make sure, you know, he made sure I took that time off. You know, we were pretty progressive as far as benefits and things. And so, but he made sure, for example, that like certain kind of like massage therapy, I tried acupuncture, like that, that was just taken care of. And he had this, not that I'm like an incapable baby, but had this, his assistant helped me, you know, he really helped me get all that stuff done. Just talking to him, you know, working with him, it was just an amazing, it was just a really good experience. He was just almost like a rock. And it, yeah. I would say like it was a storm, but it wasn't like, it was a good storm, you know, it wasn't devastating. And yeah, so that- he was really good. And he brought in this woman, Karen Jackie, who was, she helped us with process. So she helped. So I took a company from 5 people to 150 people. So I have, you know, I have a, you know, the company is different from 0 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 50, 50 to, I don't know why 80, 50 to 100, 100 and, you know, more. And, you know, we brought her in both to, you know, help and coach our executive team. She really helped with this internal assessment and stuff. And then I worked with her on overhauling all of our, you know, internal processes. How do, you know, how do we go, you know, at, when we got to 30 people, so by the way, at the time we only hired rock stars. And I don't want to hire rock stars. The problem with, you know, the thing is like, when do you see more than one rock star on a stage? Okay, yeah, maybe there's five, because but one guy is singing, one guy's playing drums. You don't see more than that on stage. Like if you see 30 rock stars on stage, it's like, it's the Grammys or it's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you're not going to buy that record. You know, it's not, it's, you know, so I like symphony, right? So we had 30 rock stars in the room. Like things started not to get done. Like we were pretty, but like arguments. We had QA go to war with user experience. Like QA started filing user experience bugs. User experience started filing QA bugs. It was, and basically, you know, I disagree with product management, so I'll do what I want. Like, no, you're smart. But, you know, so we moved to symphony, right? Which was, you could be the best that you can be, but there's still a conductor. Like, you know, maybe you bring in an expert like Yo-Yo Ma for a solo. Great. Consultant, you know, but then there's the drums, the violin, maybe drums as DevOps. I saw them as DevOps. The strings or the front end. I don't know. I just like that.
No, I like that being a drummer, you know, the drummer's laying down the foundation. So that works for
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody, but you know, nobody, when it's running, people are fine. Cause all the other fun music's happening. So no one's going to compliment them. And when it breaks, everyone notices.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Well, this is actually kind of a good segue. I mean, you're talking about some of these transformations between different org sizes and stuff, and that's kind of right where I wanted to kind of jump into, which, you know, for the individual, how are you treating individuals and their growth and so forth at varying stages, right? You have, like you said, that 5-person team or whatever, and you're able to, you know, do one set of things. And how does that look for you? And maybe you could go through some of the stories, some of the growth, success stories that you've got there. This is kind of a good place to change gears.
Well, certainly size and scope matter and affect it, right? If I'm at a big company and I have a, and I've carved out an education budget and I proactively send you to conferences, or even just to attend, you know what I mean? That can be a big deal for companies. Like a super small scale startup might not have the money to pay for you to go to something, right? So you figure out a way to go on your own. So at Big Step, one of the, you know, the core experience of going from 0 to 150 people, I learned a lot about transforming, you know, a company from 0 to 12 people, 12 to 25, 25, 50, 50, 100, and what changes. Processes will always break down. You start to not know people. Ideally, you're having bigger and better budgets, and that's a great thing. You know, but are you bringing in the right people to help you grow? Dot, 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 dot. So there's certain kind of, I think, truths that apply regardless of where you are. And then there's also things that, you know, you can do more and less based a startup versus a large company, for example. So when I'm, so by the way, some of my, you know, growth, you know, sometimes it's selfish, right? I'm not lazy, but delegating is a key skill and trust, you know, developing trust and then being comfortable and confident in delegating things is big as a CTO. And so in part, some of the, it's like this is kind of a survival mechanism. Like you're kind of crazy not to build up your team, right? It sounds silly to say it like that. But parts of this are survival mechanisms. It's not to say I don't want to do certain tasks, but other people are better and more suited and I need to grow and groom them into that. So I feel much more comfortable about that. So when I look at growth, you know, grooming people, growing them up, you know, kind of taking my own formative experiences of like training and cross training. You know, for example, when I hire, when I look for people, I'm looking for 2-in-1s and 3-in-1s. You know, the not just the front end engineer that likes the front end, but also maybe has a little bit of the designer, can kind of imitate what other people do and can help us kind of move forward. The back end API guy that can also do some stuff on DevOps. You know, now when you come in to an inherited situation, like, you know, inherited is code for, I didn't hire these people. I was hired in after that. and you may hire the wrong people too, anyways, you know, it's, you want to get to that, you know, this kind of ideal scenario, you know, so how do you do that? I think early in my career, you know, especially at Big Step, right, I was really uncomfortable a lot of times. A lot of it was not having the words. A lot of it was just not having the practice. You know, 5 people uncomfortable. I knew the 10 or 12 because 25, I don't know these people. Like when they were 150, I could not talk in front of the whole company. I just couldn't do it. I could now. I could, for sure I could. But a lot of that's just practice and comfort and then having done these things before. I kind of think of like top down and bottom up. If I look at like a sophisticated company, you know, if I'm looking to join a company, you know, as a CTO, I might, or if I'm looking to build a company from scratch with a CEO, you know, I'm really looking to make sure that there's a strong tech culture, not that it owns or dominates, but that, you know, they're going to listen and support the engineers. They're going to, you know, not just growth, but like carve out time to do tech debt. Tech roadmap, things like that. But that also, you know, they may not have a budget, but they are, you know, they are committed. They do want the team to grow, right? I'm not saying I interview to make sure like, oh, you're not just siloing engineers because they're good at what they're doing, you know, and you're just going to keep them there forever, which is kind of a misery in the long run for the engineer. You know, but how do you keep people happy? How do you keep them productive? How do you, you know, you don't, it's not the law that says you have to keep them happy, but happy people are the most productive.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of retention, I mean, you've seen a lot of CVs, I'm sure. You look at people's time at companies, and if they're there nowadays, if they're there 2 or 3 years, that's a good run. And actually, sometimes when you look at a CV and see somebody that's been at a company 15, 20 years, it's the opposite effect. It's like, what were you doing? But yeah, you know, I give them a little bit of slack if it's like a Microsoft where they had a lot of room to lateral and do
right
and so forth. But yeah, I mean, during their time there, it's really important to give them opportunities for diversity and so forth. And
So I can kind of talk, you know, I was mentioning there's kind of like the kind of generic stuff, right? Whether you're small or large, you know, I encourage you like top down, bottom up, like top down, you know, there's the commitment from the company, you know, kind of training and growth is embedded in your roadmap, right? I espouse a framework, people, process, technology. It's never just technology, so people, right? You're bumping up and filtering up. Maybe you have a new stack. You don't just do new for new's sake to do new things, you know, new tech stacks, but if you have a justification, maybe you need training. How do you get into it? If you're experiencing pain and you need to migrate, you know, there's all kinds of kind of top-down road mapping that then migrates all the way down to like whether it's OKRs or most important tasks or, you know, whatever framework that you have. But now that's kind of like a top down, and that's what you want. And that's definitely something I bring to the table and make sure I embed in the company. And that's something you want to look for. So kind of top down, what's the environment like? Is it fertile for the, you know, growing tech minds? And obviously the whole company too, not just tech people. Then there's also bottom up, right? Which is like I read articles and I took a project management class or management class, and it's, you know, it's easy to say regular ongoing conversations, you know, but I'm not saying like at every day at nine, I meet each and every members of my team and I look at their career path and we talk about it. And then, you know, you don't do that every day, right? There is a cadence of like weekly, daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, right? Some companies do like, and a lot of this is depending on your company culture, like you 360 reviews, like you, some companies don't have a formal review cycle, right? So yeah, on this kind of bottom, even big ones. And I you should do that. Even if your company doesn't do it, you should, and at least kind of have a structure, right? And so I also, for me, people process technology, or sometimes people process product technology. It just helps me think. So a lot of what I do, you know, both in interviewing and then if I'm coming into inherited engineers, and this is both when I was looking for work and for the people I bring in, you know, what I'm looking for is if what you want to do is what I need and what you're good at, you're good at what I need, then the magic can happen, kind of thing, right? And I'm not going to get into kind of the art, like interviewing, right? That's not really what this is about. Well, how do I, are they lying to me? Like, whatever. But, and from a, on a basic level, like I'm talking to, you know, I'm talking to my team like all the time, kind of thing, right? So, you know, 25 years and plus into my career, is kind of, it's formalized, I would argue, in this case. Like, I have templates and stuff I can take to new companies that I go to and all that, where, you know, getting into kind of more the mechanics of what I do, right? If it's a small company, you know, whether you have junior engineers, you're trying to push them, you know, there's this kind of pattern where you want autonomous engineers, right? The more experience they have, they should be more senior, they should be able to do things, right? Get things done. Okay, let me think for a moment.
Yeah, so how, the question is, how do you transform a junior engineer into someone who's like autonomous, right?
Okay, so what I do is this. I kind of have an outline. I typically write down like, people, process, tech, because it helps me. Like people is things like, you have a team of 8 or 16 and you need one or two or three of them to kind of be tech leads, right? Tech lead is kind of pseudo code for you're an engineer, you code, but you also do some project management. You might be the main project manager, but there might be a main one, but you're kind of managing these other engineers. Well, were you trained in that, right? I think a lot of companies have this assumption of just, oh yeah, you can do it. If you can do the tech, that they think tech's easy, but oh, that's hard. You obviously can do this other stuff too. And so part of it is on the people side, I'm both looking at role coverage to make sure here's all the roles that I need and that we're actually using and are important to our business. And then I'm looking at the people and how do they fill the roles that I need. And then at the same time, I'm talking to them, you know, both, you know, I might take like a month, maybe a little more when I join a company or get into a situation. But at some point I'm doing roughly like a quarterly, like let's write out what your goals are, like what we want you to do. And it's, you know, again, organized people, process, tech. So on people, right, I need you to do project lead. So it might be like, we're going to have you take this class. We're going to have you join this project management group. Like I need you to do these things, right? By the way, when I was like the MIT Media Lab, they took me to an Apple conference and the grad student, he was like, okay, you don't have to do anything, but I'm going to give you homework. You need 3 business cards and they have to be interesting people. Well, what's interesting, like blah, 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 related to, anyways. So he gave me homework, right? You always want people around you like that. Anyway, so at a quarterly level, I'm kind of, you have a cycle of just setting this core. Just you've talked kind of formally about what you want to do. And it's, so people, process, tech, it's both based on what I need and the organization, right? So sometimes, so for example, at Start Engine is getting into trading systems. And so it's kind of like, well, who likes that stuff? Who's into it? And there also has to be like a functional and technical fit kind of thing, right? But we're kind of like, it's a new thing for the company. We're kind of fishing around. Okay. Then we kind of lock it in. There's the mechanics of migrating off some of their tasks to other people, right? But I'm also, by the way, I'm constantly training and cross-training people, right? So sometimes I'm pushing them and asking them to do things they might not have thought of, but it's at least, I do my best to align it with what they need and want. Sometimes you just can't help it. It is what it is.
Yeah, that's key, right? I'm challenging people outside their comfort zone, you know?
Yeah. And so process-wise, right? I put like specking in process. I don't think that's a tech skill necessarily. You populate it with tech data, but the skill is really a process thing. And so I might, you know, for example, if you're doing front-end work, I will push you. I'm not saying you have to be a UX guy, but can you use like Envision? Like, can you take the stuff we got from Envision and run with it? Like, and do new stuff? Like, that's a 2-in-1, that's a 3-in-1, right? Yeah, can I train you to do that? How can you do some UX specs? I don't care if it's like PowerPoint or Google Sheets or if it's in Envision, it doesn't matter, you know, as long as it's useful, you know what I mean? And looks decent so people aren't confused with your formatting. And so, you know, on process, right? It could be product and project management, right? You may be, some companies, if you're really weak in product, they're actually, the engineers are writing the requirements, like, whoa, you know, you need to know that. Or you're at least supporting the writing of core requirements. And so training people up in that, hey, take a crack at it. Sometimes trying to get them to be a public face on smaller things, or if they're talking outside the company, like, hey, craft the email that goes out. Like, you know, for example, at like StartEngine, we had a partnership with Prime Trust. It's not that I didn't have time to talk to them, but there was one of our, you know, engineers, we had two guys that were basically director types. And I was like, I need you to just own this relationship. And I just hadn't seen how he interacts. So I just made sure I saw what he was writing, kind of tweaked it a bit. And I'm like, okay, you're on your own. Okay, you could do it. I'm fine with you. And this is even like back at Big Step, I had my CEO did it to me. And I was like, we're peers, but I'm like, but he was kind of the business brain. And we all kind of respected that. So I've kind of accepted that my whole life. And I think that's a good pattern. So that's, you know, kind of going people, going process. And then I'm also pushing you on kind of the cross training as well. Like, are you working with marketing or not? Like, here, let's get into this. Let's figure out like how we, you know, X, Y, Z, or how do you talk to them, or how we draw this out of them, or get them to work maybe better, that kind of thing. And then you kind of get into like the product and technology bits, which I can go into that, but that there's kind of more, there's more support, but as long as I'm making sure, right, that I'm helping you carve out the time, I'm either supporting you with new projects that fit either a new tech footprint or a new challenge. Now I'm also perhaps challenging you in owning something, right? You have to burn down all the reds or priority ones. You have to do blah, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be like learn this new thing. It might be a quality issue, which is not directly right. It might, you know, could be bug counts. It could be, and all this. And so you're teaching them at the same time as much as you can, like product project management. And so that's how I'm pushing them. Not, you know, not that you have to be like me, but you need, there's lots of things you got, you know, not exactly like me, but like these patterns are strong and these patterns are good. Kind of then, and that's kind of my top-down perspective. And then bottom up, you know, I've both coached other CTOs and, you know, that I'm not, you know, people I'm not managing, but also people I'm managing. And a lot of it is, you know, I can stereotypically or joke like, ah, it's social skills, it's this and that. A lot of it could just come down to like experience and practice. You know, I know CTOs that like, I just can't get in front of talk to people. I'm like, okay, well, all you're doing is presenting information. People think you know everything and you're just, nobody cares. Just, you know, building up their confidence. Or, you know, so I'll do things like, it could, you know, if you don't feel like you can present at a conference, because I'm going to try to get you to do that.
Right.
Can you work the door at the conference? I'm going to make you meet 5 or 10 people, but do it your way. You know what I mean? Don't you have to do like me, or, you know what I mean? Don't talk to the 10 senior engineers because you're intimidated, you know,
yeah.
Just talk to people. But then getting into things like I helped run a guild, kind of in a formative time. I was organizing 40 man pickup raids in World of Warcraft. Talk about a nightmare, right? Like running video game guilds. That's not a bad idea. You know what I mean? So it's a little bit like, doesn't have to be tech. It just has to be something where you're pushing yourself that way. Here's my joke. What's the difference between like a CTO and an engineer? Social skills. And I had one CTO go, it's almost true. A little bit. And then also just kind of one other thing too is a couple other things too, right? Is rotation, right? Both as I can't just have one person knowing one thing, right? And you're just not randomly giving people stuff. You're explaining why you do these things, right? And I have some good roadmap. Now in my career, I have good roadmapping techniques. Back then, I just knew, you know, 15 years ago, just don't have only one person knowing this, at least write it down, at least do these things, right? And so I'll have junior, you know, if you're not doing, most people don't do like, you know, automated pushes, right? You'll at least have someone trigger it still. There's, you know what I mean?
I do.
I'm literally spacing on those acronyms, like CICD. Right, yeah. But I teach, you know, so we have all the, you know, with the appropriate controls, right? I don't let all the junior engineers into the production system, but I might well let one in at a time, or even better, you create, you know, if I need to go in as a god, okay, I have that role created. Or if I'm just the release engineer, I only get release skills, right? You're smart about creating your security groups, you know, but you also try to do things like, if you log into production, the background is red. Why is the background red? Because you're in production. Like, I want you to have the fear of God, but at the same time, I don't need to be paralyzed with fear, you know, should you be the only guy around and have to do something. And so rotation in both specific, maybe critical skills, maybe more than one person needs to know, rotation in sometimes certain areas of your product are more fun than the others, like maintaining second, third, fourth, fifth iterations or more. And I'm not even talking about 0.0, 0.1, 0.1, 0.8 releases, you know, versus doing the new stuff, right? There's that to consider. Sometimes it's just, you know, really around, I want your React skills up. So I'm going to partner you with this guy. I do a lot of partnering as well.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's not quite paired programming, but they are pretty much as paired programming. It's more that intensive, like problem solving, work together, and they're not full time together. You know what
I mean? Yeah. So along the lines of growth, right? I'm looking for, have you ever had some friction points, whether it's with management, CEOs, environmental stuff? Like, you have all these great aspirations as a leader and you want to see the growth, but what else has gotten in the way of that sometimes?
So there's kind of like the dark side, which is if you go early stage, and I'm not necessarily saying these people are unethical, but there are definitely some of them. I'm talking about just people with irrational expectations, or I've had many projects where the budget just isn't there. It's just not materialized, right? It's lip service. And You want to get as good at kind of, it's this notion, vet them harder than they vet you. Every gig I've had, I've vetted them harder, right? Half of them, I'm sure, didn't know I'm choosing, you're not choosing, you know.
You mean partners? Mean partners and CEOs or?
Yeah, at any company you're working at, right? Like,
yeah, okay.
You know, you're going to read the Glassdoor reviews. You're going to talk this. Like, I'm going to ask them, how does product and project management work? Because that actually gives me a ton of insights. I have this belief that you need to have product, project, and knowledge management systems. Those three systems run a company. So I always run through them. Like, knowledge management, show me your intranet. How do you institutionalize memory? How do you remember things, right? What's cool is these days I have these indicators. I can see how these systems are running. And you can, if the product management system is a mess, usually there's a top-down problem getting ideas into people's heads, right? So for me, a lot of the friction is coming in from just, and this is a lot of function of my career, is just not working with great people, right? Like my worst boss ever, we hired this guy. He was H-1B, had an Indian accent. And this worst boss ever, straight up racist, you know, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, but never said anything over it. Like, this guy, creepy, everyone that met him called him creepy. Anyways, he comes up and goes, hey, we got to fire Shaker. I'm like, what? You know, like, what are you talking about? And basically it's just, he couldn't understand what he was saying. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, look at what he's doing. And yeah, I had some communication issues with Shaker, but that's, you know, I call it the culture of affirmation with India. You know, just keep asking questions till you get the, you know, we worked. It's just normal cultural stuff. Nothing I'm trying to be any kind of weird about, right? And he was great, you know. We had a fun one day. It took us like 6 hours to find an issue. And I was like, you know, the first question in my mouth was like, did you update the config file? 6 hours later, we forgot to update the config file. But it was intense experience, but it was a positive one, you know. It was versus another experience with the guy who, you know, show me your code changes in the last week. He couldn't do it, right? I'm like, you haven't done anything in a week. Like, literally, you don't know how to do this. Anyways, but enough about that guy. I guess, you know, things are going to win. It's just people and expectations is really the biggest part, right? As I'm vetting these opportunities, as I got further in my career, I'm vetting for my ability to just let me kind of do what I do. Now I can articulate and explain all the things that I do in depth and in detail. But also, I don't know if it's the older I get, but I'm just less like, I don't want to deal with your crap. You know, like, if you don't believe in educating your team, I can't help you. Like, I've left companies because they weren't, you know, like, this big step was fantastic. Like, we hired these experts, they became our bosses, and I learned. So yeah, it really comes down to culture. I got to say, it's the number one, the friction, right? Is it's not the company. And as part of interviewing, you can pretty quickly figure that out. You know, you just ask simple things. You know, like, how do you learn? How do you do new things? Like, oh, I've been stuck doing this thing for 3 years now. You're like, ooh. Now, either they're bringing you in to help solve that, or that's a warning sign that something's up.
Let's change gears again and go over go over to the career pathing side of things. So,
Okay.
So far we've been talking about growth and lots of great strategies for enabling that within your organization and so forth. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about managing individual contributors' career path. So for example, when they come into your org, maybe they're a junior engineer or developer, and you know, you hope they're going to spend some time with you. Maybe in 3 or 4 years, they're going to make it to some other level on the ladder or two. And in fact, it's not just a ladder. A lot of people consider two ladders in their org, an engineering path to success and one for management. So how do you deal with the fact that the engineers certainly have an arc in their career before you're working with them, and they have aspirations certainly after they leave your company, because nothing lasts forever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do you help move every individual contributor along this arc? And maybe what are some stories or anecdotes of how that's worked out for you?
Yeah, partially is, I have in my head, I don't really say this out loud, but I kind of want to ruin you for the next company you work for. That's my, seriously. And I do that. It's like, you know, it's just not the same. You know, someone junior coming in, you know, what do you do, right? A lot of it, you know, obviously you do an initial assessment, and it's become even more interesting in this day and age than it used to be, right? It was, in a sense, easier just if you, I was much more open, like, I've always been, just, if you could tell me your story and tell me your path and how you learned, right? If you have a computer science degree, well, can you articulate it? Can you do, say the things that a CS3 should have? Okay, great. Well, if you don't, maybe you have a physics or a math degree. Well, those are great for computer science also, just mostly the structured thinking, all that. But what about things like theater majors? I don't know about you, but I meet a ton of theater majors that do tech. It seems to be some kind of hotspot. Mm-hmm. But, you know, self-taught, Code Academy, all that, kind of what I'm really looking for is, like, for where you are today, how did you get there? In a sense, I don't care, like, how you learned. Like, did you watch videos, read books? Like, I like to read. I don't like the videos because it just takes too long to get to the point. But how do you, you know, like, I read this many textbooks. I can, you know, name drop the right things. I'm not doing stupid things like, why are manhole covers round? But, like, can you really explain things? And sometimes at a certain point, well, I'll just Google it. Or, well, I'll call Dave. I know Dave had this problem before. You know, or I'll just ask someone else. But then that's a very acceptable answer, right? And so initially, I'm just trying to assess. And then sometimes I'm also, you know, you have to, I guess, assess for failure. And we've talked about this before. In my head, I call it the too big for their britches syndrome. I think you call it toddlers raising the infants, right? And this, for me, it's this notion of like, oh, I took, whether it could be one class or the three month intensive, but now I should make $120,000 a year. I literally had a guy, he was like 24. This is like 6 or 7 years ago. He's like 24 years old. He was definitely the junior tech guy. He said in 30 days, I could rewrite the whole platform. And I forget what was there before, but all he was saying was Express, like that middle tier layer. And I hadn't seen Express yet. So I just asked like three of the CTOs. I'm like, Express, I think it's just this middleware that acts like this other thing. And they go, yeah, that's what it is. I'm like, oh, anyways. And so I just asked the guy, like, well, how do you move all the data? He's like, what? Like,
right. He's like, hold my beer.
I didn't even give him too much. I didn't put too much into it because I'm like, oh, this guy. Because he's also, and then he wanted a raise because he wanted to buy a house in Santa Monica. I'm like, you're 24. Like, I'm not going to get into politics, but unless you win the lottery, you ain't, or, you know, have mega rich parents, you ain't buying a house in Santa Monica. It ain't happening. Like, I don't get it. And so, thankfully, he self-selected out. He would have been terminated. That's my favorite. When the wrong people, they're just like, oh, I best get out of here, because then it opens up a headcount. You don't have to do anything about getting rid of them. I'm also looking to make sure they're just not crazy. I've also interviewed a guy once, and this is not, there's like right ways and wrong ways of involving other people. Like, we interviewed this guy and he comes back and we made him an offer, and he didn't double the offer, but he was like, well, I need way more money, and, you know, you said 2 weeks, I need like four to, like, I think he said 6 weeks, is at least 4 weeks off. But my wife says I need more money in 4 to 6 weeks. And we're just like, oh, great. And then he's kind of confused. He goes, oh, wait, it sounds like you have an answer. And we're like, oh, yeah. And that, we're not going to hire you, right? Like, we want to be family friendly, da, 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 you know, but like, that's not the way to do it. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to be high maintenance, dude. We don't want to work with you. You're just acting odd. Like, we don't like this.
Yep. And so, you know, the, just real quick, the odd thing, well, not the odd thing, the interesting thing I've noticed with unlimited PTO when you offer it is nobody takes it. I think 2% of the employees will take 6 weeks. A couple other percent will take 4 weeks. Hopefully 80% take 2 weeks, and then some people never take any, which we eventually force them to, right? I mean,
I would make people take time off too, right? That's part, just part of my mentality is if you're killing yourself for me and like you work all weekend, or, you know, that's as a metric, I might say working all weekend once a quarter in a startup's fine. But more than that, maybe we start to talk. Like if you're on what I call the death march, like 3 months weekends nonstop. And you might have done that at Videomp, but that's a very different story versus what a death march.
I've done it a lot of places, unfortunately.
It's just bad. You know, that's not healthy. And you want to avoid that as well. Like at this big step, we weren't in a death march, but I was clearly hurting myself. I've blown my hands off programming, basically.
Me too.
And so I compare myself to catchers and pitchers in football and baseball. What do you do? Anyway, so that's not what we're talking about. So, and that junior path, right? First, it's just that initial assessment, right? But then I'm really looking at, I'm both looking at, you know, as I'm kind of going through the tech, because it's a little easier for them to understand, but I'm also going through, I'm vetting them kind of people process. Like, are they getting the role coverage? What roles are they filling process-wise? How are they contributing? How are they working? You know, good contributor. Like, for example, when last at StartEngine, you know, one of the guys on the team, you know, he was a more junior engineer, but he was phenomenal working with the rest of the company. Right. And, but he's also kind of weak on putting together requirements and specs. Right. That was just a great fit. You know what I mean? Just saying, oh, well, guess what? We can get you to do new and bigger, better things. We're going to leverage your ability and desire. And sometimes you do it too much. So we're going to help you constrain that, you know, to both advance your career, help the company do more stuff. I'm not lazy, but now I've delegated some stuff to you. I don't have to worry about because now I'm partnering you with Joe. Because Joe used to do your area, now he's going to oversee that, but you're going to do the new stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's it's an art and science in that sense, right? Yep.
One of our mutual friends mentioned that management coming from an engineering side of the ladder is not a promotion. And I really like that, actually. I'm curious.
It depends how it's framed, right?
Yeah, right. Okay. So I'm curious, do you have any success stories bringing people from one side of the ladder to the other or back again?
There and back again. I've definitely had experience. So a big step, I was really young, and part of that, it's weird hiring your friends, like your good friends sometimes. And it was good. There wasn't like weirdness. It was more my discomfort doing that. And one of these guys, Freeform was his name. Everyone in San Francisco is an alter ego. He began running the front end developers, and after like a year or two, he's like, I don't want to do this. Not want to do it. Like, I don't like, and I'm like, in a word, I was like, okay. And it worked, you know, it worked out in the sense that he is super blunt and direct. And then I think at the time I also had this guy, John Monson. So it wasn't like a scramble, like, what do I do? We just refactored. I don't think we got anyone else. We didn't need anyone else to do that role, really. We were just trying to push him and he just didn't want to do it. I've had new people that I've pushed, but I don't consider that kind of, well, I might say I hired a guy into like a promotion, like I hired a General Assembly instructor, and I was like, oh, not as necessarily as a director, but kind of like tech lead. And this was the person who he could show you how to like in the class, like deploy your code, but he couldn't do it, you know, in a production way. It's almost like an exercise in AD. I watch him work. I'm like, I don't know what you're doing. I don't think you're getting anything done. And you can't. And this was the guy who cannot show me any local or remote changes in GitHub. Like, you've done nothing. You know what I mean? And he was like managing the other guy that I like the best student in the class. I said, who's your best student in the class? I brought this guy into StartEngine. I liked him. He's so great. That would be Beast. I'm like, say no more. Anyways, but so the guy I kept was the student because he was like a converted, converted accountant, or I forget what it was, but like a related field but not tech at 32, right? So
right,
a lot of it, like, it's not so, I would say less about managed. I don't really think of it as management, this thing, right? So for example, this guy Ryan, you know, he's coming from a non-technical background, but it's kind of like, you know, maybe an accountant or an actuary as far as details and structure and organization, right? you need to teach them iteration. And, you know, he's just really good with details. And bringing him into a second company, like kind of already knowing this guy's a known quantity, I'm immediately like, you can just take care of these things for me right away. He's like, well, I got to learn them. I'm like, yeah, you're going to learn them about a week or two. And then you can just own it. And then carving out, in a sense, partially carving out that role, I knew what his capabilities were. So I already knew what the role was and carving out. And it was just easy. In that case, he was switching, you know, when you're switching positions kind of thing, switching roles, right? So I would argue I'm not necessarily, definitely I'm not promoting you into management. It's a separate kind of siloed experience. I'm definitely giving, I call it influence versus control. I'm increasing your influence. I'd rather have influence than control. I'll take and have the control if I need it. But like at times I've taken control of product because my influence wasn't working. And then I owned it and then it was great. You know, so like, for example, this working with this guy, Ryan, it's really, well, what do you want to do with yourself? Oh, if you want to do these things, right? In this case, you know, it was not a large team. It was very small, but like I was managing all the people, right? But like he, on an individual project, he was the senior and he'd have juniors with him. And so in my first company, he was just coding, just taking the specs and running with it. At new company, he's both making the specs. In addition to this other guy, this guy's really good at vision, right? I'm like, oh, dude. Like, so he was instrumental in these specs. And then I even was able with like a major technology kind of service partner, not just like Google Suite, but like you have an API integration. It's like set heavy and serious, where in the beginning, like when I hired him, all interactions I had to come from me and go through me within 2 months. I mean, I trained him, but it was easy training. Like then he was responsible for all the interactions with the only requirement that I was CC'd on it. You know what I mean? I just needed to know what conversations were happening in particular because this was a very big high profile kind of relationship kind of thing. You know, I tend to then take advantage of, let's say, a new employee coming in or new project, new initiative to focus, retarget the team, train and cross train, right? Mm-hmm. So you might not think you're managing, right? But like, let's say, you know, Start Engine, we have had like three core product techs, right? But like, let's say Ryan owns one of them now. You know what I mean? Like he's got it. And I'm sure he'll be there for years, which would be great. And what does he do after this? I don't know, but it's going to be really awesome, right? Because I mean, I'm not there with him now, but we'll, you know. But he's the kind of guy. I'm like, oh, geez, that is just going to be great.
Yeah.
So it's both like influx points with your career, personal career, and then influx points with my company tend to be the best opportunities.
Yeah.
If your company's stagnating or not growing, I tend to not be at those companies. Or if it's like a fixing situation, which I do that a fair amount, it can become a lot harder and difficult.
Yeah. So, all right, let's round out the discussion into the home stretch here with the wild card round. These are my favorite questions, right? So, I'd like to talk about an experience that you've had from either side of the table, and you can do both if you want, interviewing. So I'm looking for horrible interview stories.
Okay. Well, the two come to mind. I can maybe get them out quick. So the first one, so this is when I was first an intern, you know, I was interning at Wired Magazine. A friend of mine we graduated the same year, both with computer science degrees. So I, you know, as an intern at Wired Magazine for 3 months, this is really my first real tech job out of MIT with a computer science degree. A friend of mine with a computer science degree got a job at Sapient. In that like friendly way, he's like, you're crazy for making $100 a week for 3 months. You're crazy making only like $17,000 or $18,000 a year as a junior engineer. Like you can make like $60,000. Woo. So, and this was kind of like in San Francisco, I was in Soma, he was north of market. So there's almost like this kind of, I don't know, geopolitical divide as far as types of companies.
Right.
Now, when I went to this company, in part, you know, I have this love-hate relationship with tech, a little bit love-hate with MIT, and that I really love the people there, but some people were just so competitive. I'm like, we're students. You don't need to be this competitive. So Sapient is one of the big consulting companies founded by MIT people. It's like 85% MIT people. So I go to this interview. Immediately into this interview, they have me take a test. So for this experience alone is probably why I hate tests.
Right.
But I'm taking this test. I'm like, and I'm also like, MIT, they're just going to write their own stuff anyways. It doesn't really matter. I'm like, this is nothing anyone I know is using. And I was also like 22 or 23, right? I'm like, maybe there is other stuff. Like IBM, I think IBM WebSphere was not a thing. In the beginning, I don't think I would have wanted to work with IBM WebSphere because I was already doing, I think, more advanced things. You know, anyways, and so they took this test and I'm like, I failed this test. Like, there's no way. You know what I mean? Like, this is, and I was like, this is a silly test. And then so I'm like, strike one. And in both cases, there's like three strikes. So that was like strike one. And then the next guy, strike two, the guy's like, well, everyone's here from MIT and it's great and this and that. And I'm like, okay, that's not really a pro for me. I'm at Wired Magazine, like dyed hair, tattoos, freaks, geeks. These people are amazing. Like, this just looks super boring. I don't know what, and, you know, so I was like, strike two. And then strike three, the guy was like, I was talking to like, who'd be a peer? Because my boss is really cool. I'm like, oh, why is your boss cool? He's like, well, see this shirt I'm wearing? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, I worked all weekend and he went across the street, Market Street, and he bought it for me for this meeting. I'm like, so you worked all, I didn't say this out loud. I'm like, so you worked all weekend for a shirt. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Oh, so this was like, dang, you know, anyways. And so it just wasn't a fit. Like, yeah, this isn't going to work out. And it sounds like more hostile and negative. It's just like, this ain't going to work out. I'll just stay south of Soma. And I wasn't really like creating lines. I was just like, okay, this isn't good. So that was kind of my first, whereas this like, it was a big company or startup. Like back then, especially if you could start up. And I love startups for career growth. You got to be very careful with who you work with. Make sure you get good people who will mentor you and help you grow. But be prepared to get burned. Now, anyway, my other interview then was with when I was living in LA. I interviewed at Disney because why not? At Disney, there were also three strikes. The first strike was when I was going to manage, like, I had like three people that I would be managing and I was talking to them all. Okay? And this girl walks by that I knew from San Francisco and she goes, oh, hey, Squishy, what's up? That was my nickname in San Francisco, Squishy. And, hi, okay, I'll interview you. I'll see you later. And one of them goes, you know that girl? I'm like, yeah, I do. He's like, so you weren't kidding. Like you can introduce us to people. Cause I was explaining like, what would I do for them? I'm like, I'd take you to events and get you to go to these things and, you know, get in the community. Like, it's really cool. And I go, yeah, I could introduce you to her. Like, why haven't you met her yet? And it turns out that she was literally in the cubicle next to her.
Oh no.
And hadn't met her for like over a year. And so I like a month later, I saw this friend. I'm like, by the way, what was that about? Like, why did the girl like not meet you? She goes, oh, I work for Toontown. We're basically like the youngest kids at Disney. Like nobody respects us. So nobody talks to us. I was like, oh, well, that sucks. Anyway, so I was like, this is a weird, I don't get this. Why are you in the same office and not talking? Versus like, this was before Hilton, right? Where everyone's from.
Right. So quick story. I actually, when I was 18 and I wrote a blog about this, I built Toontown. I worked in construction there. And
no way.
Scrapper stalker, as they called it.
Uh-huh.
And it was the hardest work I ever did in my life, and not going to go too deep into the tangent, but you know, wearing long sleeve denim in 105 degree weather with great belts and, you know, accidents and injuries and things, I'm like, holy crap, if I work this hard at learning tech.
But I was talking the online Toontown, so
oh, okay, well, I built like the real internet. One
yeah. Well, we'll kind of touch on that in a sec. And so
sure.
So the next thing was they had me interview with an Imagineer. Now, all through the process, he was the last one I talked to. They're like, oh, you're talking, let's call him Dave. You're like, oh, you're talking to Dave. And like after a while, like finally the last person before him, I'm like, why do you guys keep doing that? And they're like, I figure it's something like you'll see. Like Dave's intense. I'm like, oh great. So within 2 minutes I stepped in it. Now part of it is that I think this guy was super arrogant. But basically, first question he goes is who's the target audience for Disneyland? And I'm like, for Disney, I'm like, you know, I'm not too sure. I'm going to guess families, but one of the, you know, then I said, you know, one of the things I'm interested about Disney with is I have a ton of data. Like I suspect, you know, the answer to this question already. And I'd really love to see that. And he kind of snippily goes, well, it's single mothers in this age range. I'm like,
oh no.
Like, and he's immediately, I'm like, I didn't know that. That to me is, that's just dumb. And then this is when I could hear the change in the tone of his voice. He goes, have you been to Disneyland? And I go, yeah, I've been to Disneyland. And then I go, well, hold on. I've been to, I forget which one, I've been to whichever one is in Florida. you know, Disneyland versus Disney World. But I said it, whichever one is in Florida, that you could just hear it in that guy's voice. Yeah. We talked some more, but I was like, ugh.
Oh boy.
And that was that, like, where the guy was almost like getting into that. Why are manhole covers round? Like, it's just, this, I don't like this. This is so weird. It's like overly technical, but in not a technical way. And then the last one, this is again more, but this gets into culture and stuff, right? They basically handed me like 3/4 inch stack of paperwork and said, like, hey, if you fill this out, we'll let you know if we want to talk to you. And I go, how about you tell me if you want to talk to me, and then in my head, and maybe I'll fill it out and get back to you. And they're like, no, fill it out. And so I took their paperwork and never filled it out.
Right. Yeah.
And never really heard back from them. Oddly enough, one of the guys I talked to, he's gone on to do some UX things, and I met him, I saw him again like 6 or 7 years ago. And he goes, oh my God, we remember you. And I'm like, well, we stay connected. He goes, your interview, like, everybody talks about. I'm like, I don't get it. What do you mean? Because I had obviously what I just told you. He goes, do you remember when we asked you what your spirit animal was? And by that, I was like, oh yeah. They're like, do you remember what you said? I go, I don't know, but I probably said sloth. And he goes, you did. You said sloth. And you justified it, right? Everyone says, like, bit lying and this and that. And I'm like, I'm methodical and thorough. Like, I'm still round, you know, it's like, I'm not saying you don't know I'm there. You know, I just had all these really good reasons for sloth. Right. And also, for some reason, like, I might have been meeting on it with my friends or something. Anyways, but that was like, that didn't even register with these other like 3 strikes, but that was one where, like, you know, why are they asking me my spirit animal? And I'm not in a creative brand, you know, I'm not trying to like wow them in that way.
Right.
So those were just, as I was rising up, I was just like, you know.
Oh boy.
And just as far as like super mini example on the other side, this was more like after the guy was hired, but I was talking to this, the worst guy on the team, and he said something. And right after our meeting, I went to the CEO and I go, hey, this guy said something. And she goes, what'd he say? He goes, he said during his interview, he told you he didn't get our product, didn't like it, and didn't really like the company. And she goes, oh yeah, I remember that. And I go, okay, I'm going to make a new rule. And I kind of start like slightly chuckle. I'm like, how about this? Anyone else that ever says this in an interview, we don't hire them.
So, how about we dismiss them a little early too?
Yeah, right? how about that? You know, like, then we just avoid this situation entirely. So
yeah, just to recap a little bit there. I've had, well, I don't know if I ever mentioned, there was a period of my life for about 10 years, you know, about the early 2000s, where I just had my first kid, and mm-hmm. I was really worried about providing and so forth. And mm-hmm. it was an irrational fear, but still I interviewed about once a month for 10 years. And so I've interviewed about 120 times with a lot of companies. And so I've seen the good and the bad and the ugly there. And one of the themes there is like when people try and set up puzzles and traps and they're looking for immediate epiphanies from you for things that they've had quarters and years to think about, like that's a big flag, especially if that person's your boss.
I interviewed at MySpace long time, well after this was when I was like, there's not much going on. I'm going to look at MySpace. You know, they're trying to, like, the last year or two, their last dying throws. And then I ended up in this meeting with the executive who kind of like drew me a graph and was like, what does this mean? And like, and it was again kind of back to that like Imagineer, like, wrong, the premise is flawed. You're like, what? Like, where are you going? Like, I was just like, dude, like, he's like, I'm trying to get how you think. I'm like, no.
That's not how we do this.
Yeah. And it was just kind of like, I don't know, you know.
And actually one other quick thing.
That wasn't like bad. That was just kind of like a flat note. Just like, it wasn't bad. I wouldn't argue bad. I was just like,
Yeah. I guess one other quick thing there is, you know, HackerRank was one of our cousin companies. So we got a sweetheart deal early on and we were using it. And, you know, it worked well for junior devs and kind of filtering. I mean, we didn't really even hire junior devs at VideoAmp until like year 3 almost, but like it helped us with like kind of filtrating all the submissions we get. But what we found out eventually, just using it more and more and architecting tons of different tests and so forth, is that the more senior the talent and the more, you know, diverse the talent, et cetera, those folks go, screw you, I'm not taking your HackerRank test.
They're just smart.
Just bring me in, you know, I'll peer program with you, I'll whiteboard, whatever. But, you know, these things, it's like that big 3/4 inch thick thing of paper. It's like, I'm not going to do a 4-hour buy-in to get you.
Yeah. Attention. Like, I know some guys like more creative, right? Where this is a guy I knew, he was trying to get like an animation job. He did like a 40-hour like concept, you know what I mean? And it's partially they could have taken it and ripped them off, like, but you worked, and I don't know how many other people applied. You're just, right. I'm like, whoa, like that is, that was on the creative discipline, but I was like, that is nuts.
Yep. Yep. True story. I went to Chico State for computer science, and we had a Silicon Graphics indie lab with like stations and Onyx.
I did the demo for the out of box experience for their Octane.
Oh, nice.
We did the demo for those.
Yeah. Oh, right on. And long story short, we had Alias Wavefront, and I took 2 years of animation there and really digged it. And it's funny because they only had one site license, but somebody hacked it to make it run on all of them. And after a couple of years, they're starting to churn out all these talented animators, and Will Vinton Studios and a couple others would come and recruit. And they're like, wait a minute, Alias caught wind of this. And they're like, how did you start pumping out all these people? And once they realized that their software had basically been hacked, they're like, oh, and then they started giving university licenses and stuff like that in a bigger way.
Well, hopefully they realized hopefully they're realizing it's helped driving their own growth, and they're not like, let's stamp it out, like, well,
totally. And you know, for me, the web was new then too, and I had the chance to go into the animation field, but it was a similar thing with the internships. Like, you basically
I actually made animations my first year at this research lab, right? Like visualizing it was macro media director.
Oh yeah, I remember.
Ultimately became Flash.
Yep, I remember. So I mean, the problem that I found though was all these animation studios wanted you to basically get coffee and take out the trash and do all, like, free internships for 3 months to get in. And it was just, you know, I'm kind of glad I took the other path and went towards the web.
Well, one kind of really big part of my career, which is, it was definitely not manufactured luck, but right time, right place, like when I was born and all that. So if I can, my brother is like a year and a half, 2 years younger, and he was in entertainment for a long time. And he, you know, if you look at a pyramid, right, you know, he was a production assistant, ultimately got up into writer, right, this whole path. But he was at one point 100-hour-a-week production assistant. I don't remember, this was different jobs, but so I'll make it sound a little worse, but like 2 car accidents on the LA freeway and mono for a month, right? Like, got beat up really bad, right? And then just, you know, but it's this, there's this formal hierarchy, whether it's formal or it's political or whatever, you know what I mean? There's these hurdles you got to go up. Now, if, you know, what I am so appreciative and was so lucky, and what tech still enables, it might be just a little harder to find, is that like with these kind of shrink wrap waterfall companies, right? I would have gone into a pyramid situation, right? Junior engineer, like, oh, do I want to go management? Do I want to be a senior scientist? Like, let me think about this. Basically, I feel that because I got into such a new and nascent field, I jumped onto the top of the pyramid, and then the pyramid went up. And in part, that's what also helped me a ton. So, you know, I think I said before, I kind of have like an effective MBA. Like, I could, arguably, I have an effective master's in computer science. I'm not going to say that because I don't. I mean, I kind of did, but, right. But I'm sure I could get a master's pretty easy, you know, other than the pain of doing homework again, relative to what I know now. It's just silly, you know, in that sense. But the kind of pyramid went up with me, right? And there's founding companies earlier and this and that. And so, I do recommend those. I mean, it is a bit risk based, and if you want one last story,
one more story.
Rolling Stone magazine wrote an article about me in 1995, and a few other friends. The premise of the article is this: the article starts off pretty much like this. When John Schiple moved to San Francisco, he had never heard of the term geeksploitation. And this is one of those, when I read the article, it's like, well, I'd never heard of geeksploitation until I read the article either. But what he interviewed about us was accurate. He kind of came up with the term later. And it was this notion of kind of willing self-sacrifice, meaning, you know, I have an MIT degree. I can make bank. Why am I working at $100 a week? Well, do you know what Wired Magazine is? Like, yeah. it's that, you know, it's a way to invest in yourself, kind of thing. So, but, you know, the article is true to form, but it's, and I would, especially in the 90s and the 2000s starts to tape off, and I don't do this as much just because where I'm at, but, you know, if it's especially an early stage company, right? Or if, you know, this is not the focus of this call, but if you're taking a pay cut, right, to join a company, well, are you getting that much experience, that much board access, that much product or project management experience that you might not have had? You know, how are you growing and stretching yourself? It's that, you know, if you're at a bad company, they will exploit you. Can you turn exploitation into geeksploitation where you're going to get just as much out of it? Yeah. Anyway, I just, you know, in my younger career, I was more abusive on myself. And part you learn better, but also it's a lot of it is learning. Like, I think I built like 3 full-on data warehouses that never got used. And then I was like, I'll just write a simple report first. And then if you wanted to automate it. And then if we have volume, we'll build the warehouse. So yeah, anyways.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. You definitely have a Forrest Gump like pathing. You've met a lot of really cool, famous people. I've talked to very few people that have met Tim Berners-Lee. So that's really cool. And somebody
there's no way I do not know him, you know, but
no, I know,
taught our class and it was a lucky time. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, thanks a lot for your time, John. This has been really great. And I look forward to more discussions with you.
Can't wait.
Right. So thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, I appreciate it.